welcome to What She Said. I'm your host, Lucy Ucroft, a journalist, blogger and podcaster based in Brighton, and you're listening to Series 4, Episode 10, Busting Diet Culture Myths with Rose Wright, a.k.a. Live a Well Life. Rose is a registered intuitive eating nutrition specialist. Is that a nutritionist? Anyway. And mum of three, plus one big fur baby. She shares practical advice and busts nutri bollocks on her Instagram with specialist courses and through one-to-one coaching work with private clients, including me. After following Rose for a while and finally working with her on both mine and my toddler's nutrition, I knew I wanted to chat with her for the podcast. I need to put my teeth in. We delve into Nutribollocks, diet culture and the influencer marketing sphere, and why carbs are great. If you liked, nay, loved this episode and the podcast in general, please think about doing one of the following things. You could leave a review or just a rating or both on iTunes. I know it's a faff and I haven't found an easy way to do it. And if you don't have iTunes, then you can't do it at all. But it's free, at least monetarily, and makes a huge difference to whether the show is seen by people or not. It really boosts What She Said in the algorithm. Or you could support me on Patreon. You could leave a $1 tip in the tip jar or sign up for a monthly contribution in exchange for various bonuses. Tiers start from $1 a month, but the bonuses start from $5 a month. I really appreciate it. Thank you to all my amazing patrons this week. I've had a couple of newbies and some people bumping from $5 to $35. So that's amazing. And to everyone who's supported me from the very start or from the middle or from right now. I love you all. You're amazing. And another big shout out to the Facebook group, the What She Said Facebook group, which I started a couple of years ago. Year and a half ago, can't remember, has been just the most wonderful community, and it's changed and evolved, but the one kind of thread that runs through it is that everyone's just really great and supportive. So I wanted to say thanks to every single one of the members. That's enough from me.
My name is Rose and I am a nutrition and lifestyle coach. And I specialise in a non-diet approach. So that means that clients who come to see me, I support them around body acceptance and learning to trust their bodies. And I promote health behaviours and changes within them that support their overall health and well-being rather than chasing intentional weight loss or a number on the scales. And I use intuitive eating techniques in my practice to facilitate that. And I think I came to that area of or that kind of framework quite naturally because it spoke to me as someone who probably had fallen foul of diet culture historically. It's sort of the non-diet approach and intuitive eating and tuning back in to trusting your body and its internal cues felt very right and very easy. And that's why I am here now, hoping to preach the same.
And how did you get into this? Because it's a long journey to this, right? But a fairly recent career.
Yeah, no, it is. It's been a bit of a midlife career change for me, to be honest. I've spent 16, 17 years in marketing and publishing. But I have had a fascination with nutrition and health for a long time. I think initially a lot of that was part of the wellness culture and being a bit of a slave to that and the sort of healthism ideal that, you know, I could create this incredibly healthy life for myself and my children and my family. And that sort of spurred the initial interest. And then my son, who is now almost 13, he was diagnosed with autism at 7. And there's a lot of talk within the world of autism about the interactions between diet and some sensory behaviours and helping them manage their anxiety. And that sort of took me down that avenue for a while from a personal point of view, because I wanted to know what I could do to support my son. And I realised that there were certain changes I made to his diet that had a very positive impact on him and his sense of well-being. And I guess that's where I began to see how changes and stress management techniques, I should say, and helping him create good sleep and all of those things that we generally need as a general population. But for him specifically, are much harder for him to manage on his own. And seeing the very positive impact of that on him was incredible. And it sort of was a moment in time for me. And I've got to a point in my life, I was in my late 30s, and I thought, if I don't do something else now, I'm never going to do it. Mm. So I made the leap. And it was whilst studying and whilst qualifying, it was actually an alumni of the qualification I did who started talking about health at every size. And she had started talking about the intuitive eating framework and the work of Evelyn Trifoli and Eliza Wiesch. And I picked up the book one day and that was it. It was, that made sense. So after I qualified, I did some CPD qualifications in intuitive eating in practice. And yeah, I haven't looked back since, to be honest.
What's CPD?
Oh, sorry, continuous professional development.
Oh, I see. And also, for anybody who doesn't know, what is intuitive eating? I'm sure that the majority of people listening to the podcast will have heard the term intuitive eating, which is something that I want to talk to you about because certainly I've recently read a book on it. I've spoken to you and I'm in your world watching your stories and things like that. So I'm picking up things from qualified people, but for many, many years, I was hearing things that were kind of nonsense. So I'd love for you to explain the reality, the truth of intuitive eating.
The truth of intuitive eating. So, I think intuitive eating, like all these things, has been partially co-opted by diet culture. So you will see it coming up in different guises. It might be the mindful eating approach or the hunger and fullness diet. Intuitive eating is not a diet. It is a framework that was created by two registered dietitians who are actually US based. And it's based on 10 principles, but in snapshot, it entails eating in response to your psychological hunger and fullness cues, learning to pay attention to your body, to recognize and trust these internal cues to guide our eating, and to understand our emotional relationship with food and how that can play a very big part, and how self-care and applying strategies to overcome emotional eating can support you to have a healthier relationship with food. It talks about encouraging movement for joy, you know, moving your body in a way that feels good, not because you feel you have to exercise to burn calories or to earn your food. And it's based on very flexible principles, not rigid rules. But it starts out at the very beginning with the rejection of diet mentality, because it recognises that diets as a prescription don't work. We know that less than 20% of individuals who partake in sort of what we call controlled weight management or intentional weight loss will maintain that weight after a year, and that number falls even further in year two. And that's for lots and lots of reasons, not least because when we diet and we set ourselves up for restriction, we experience deprivation, and deprivation creates cravings, which then can lead on to anxiety around food, and a disordered kind of relationship with food, and then this sort of a restriction and backlash eating kind of scenario can play out. And diet culture also feeds anxiety around our food choices, and guilt and shame and feelings of failure. And all of those things have a very negative impact, not only on our relationship with food, but our relationships with our body and how we perceive ourselves and our levels of body satisfaction. And then there are very, you know, go into the biology of it. You know, your body holds, has very strict parameters that it likes to keep your weight. You know, we all have a natural, what we call set point weight. And that's the weight where our body functions most effectively. And that's the weight you are when you eat normally and you exercise normally without any kind of severe restriction or you know, too much thought in it. Just, you know, I'm doing this because I'm living my life well. But thanks to diet culture and sort of the thin ideal and this pursuit for thinness, a lot of individuals will try and push their natural weight or achieve a weight that's much lower than they should be, or would naturally balance out at. And the body fights back against that. And there's lots of things that happen. You know, it will slow down our metabolism. It will send out certain peptides that make us crave carbohydrates. It will pump out hormones to increase our appetite and taste receptors in the brain to make foods seem even more appealing. And as a result, when we begin to eat more normally, we don't restrict again, our weight will ping back up and then normally plus some, because your body's trying to protect and preserve a healthy weight. So there's lots and lots of studies that have shown over many, many years that restrictive eating and dieting isn't successful. Yeah. So, yeah, but more importantly, intuitive eating looks at health from a very holistic point of view, and that, you know, a number on the scales is not a measure of overall health,
which
at all
I think is part of how insidious diet culture is. And I wonder if anybody listening has ever looked into, has ever read any kind of feminist book even, and or any kind of diet culture book. I mean, in fact, it doesn't even have to be diet culture. I would say feminism because I think it's a real patriarchal thing, diet culture. It all comes down to white supremacy and the patriarchy, really.
No, it does, absolutely.
Because diet culture is in everything. And I would say the majority of us are consuming kind of nasty diet culture messages without realizing through the media. That's probably where most of us are getting the most accessible messages, really. And part of that is Instagram, which I'm 100% not Instagram shaming, because I love Instagram, but I'm particularly interested to talk about you mentioned the kind of wellness. And as you know, as a vegan, I'm very, very aware of some of the various movements that have led to things like orthorexia and masquerading as essentially wellness. And I'd love to talk about that. A couple of people that I really want to mention are the Hemsley sisters, who I hate. I can say that. You might not want to say that, because they mentioned leaky gut.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly.
As a syndrome, it doesn't exist as a disease.
Yeah. And so I curse them for making people think they need to be gluten-free when they don't. And also Deliciously Ella, because I've never made a recipe of hers and it's worked, so I just don't like her. So I'm just going to point those two out as two people who I think are absolute crap.
Fair enough. I mean, I think what the wellness movement has done is that it is, and diet culture together, they've created this halo effect around certain foods and eating behaviours. But actually what they're doing is selling very controlled and restrictive eating, and we feel very guilty when we don't conform to that. I think we see diet culture very well repackaged. It's very well marketed as wellness and healthism in recent times. I don't know. I think there's an added layer to that. I think it's a very elitist thing to do. It's a very privileged thing to do, to be the individual that can buy buckwheat and spelt flour. And, you know, I can spend hours in the kitchen preparing this beautiful meal. I mean, it's absolutely reeks of privilege as number one. I do question also whether or not there is this pursuit for us to live forever, this obsession with our own mortality. And sort of this tying up with the concept of self-actualization. And we see this a lot on Instagram. So, you know, we've got so many people pumping out that you can lead this better, bigger, improved version of yourself. And, you know, sign up for my webinar and I'll tell you the secrets to how. But I think we've begun to tie health up with that. And there's this ideal, this frankly fanatical way of eating that's going to provide us with this high level of quality living that's better, more superior, more fulfilling. And it's being sold to us by very shiny, white-teethed, beautiful individuals who say it with great authority. I mean, you know, the individuals you mentioned are incredibly attractive. And they are thin. They are the thin ideal. And, you know, we are told all the time, there is a perception within society that somehow being thin is, makes you morally superior, aesthetically superior, and must be the elite in terms of health. So as you say, I think social media feeds are full of diet talk. I think it's hidden and manifesting as lifestyle.
Yes.
Or Fitspo.
Yes.
For me, my bugbear is Fitspo. Because I'll come back to them in a minute, but it encourages this kind of this elitism around food, for one, and this ideal around food, but also social media encourages the self objectification. You know, it's the realm of selfies and posing a certain way to make our bodies look a certain way. And what made me think about that is Fitspo, you know, the tiny waist, the peachy ass, and you've got to have arms that are big enough to punch someone. If you're a woman at the moment, that's the attractive body shape. But studies have shown that that self-objectification is associated with much greater levels of body dissatisfaction. And I think that's incredibly prevalent. Although we're seeing a rise in men, I think it's incredibly prevalent within women because we're conditioned to please an external objectifier, and that's what Instagram audiences are.
Yes, that's so true.
So it's very tied up, you know, how you're presenting yourself and what you're consuming. I think it's, they feed each other, excuse the nutrition pun, that was accidental.
But yeah. Nice.
It's, you know, that's the truth. And there was an NHS report in 2018 that indicated that this kind of height of wellness culture, 2015, 16, 17, you know, when, you know, I don't want to name and shame, but when Delicious Ella and so forth were really at the forefront of the movement. And I'm not attributing blame to any individual by any stretch, of course. That's my caveat here. But at that moment in time, eating disorder admissions doubled. And some of that has been attributed to society's pressures and the rise of social media use.
Yeah. I mean, that's when I became vegan. Was around then. Yeah. And I mean, it's not something I've ever talked about on the podcast or even on my blog, is that I had an eating disorder most of my 20s, part of my teens, most of my 20s, and then now have reverted into disordered eating over the past probably 2 years. And that is another layer of the kind of battle that we fight as women, which is the post-baby body. That's when my disordered eating reared its ugly head. And now reading about intuitive eating and all the rest of it has been spurred on by the fact that I don't want Anais to grow up with those messages. I don't, because there's something really powerful about, especially when you have a girl, I think, that you suddenly feel, it's a mirror, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would hate her to start eating the way I ate as a child, that's my motivator, really, to change my eating.
And I think we become, or I hope we become, in fact, actually, we don't, because I see it play out again and again within my own peers and circle and even family, of the language we use around food and the language we use around our own bodies. And I think there is, because we have so, we have internalized diet culture to such an extent that as parents, we become fearful of having a child that doesn't conform to a particularly aesthetically pleasing body shape. Even if genetics is telling you something, that child's body shape is going to be something different. You know, that is also something that is very, very prevalent. And I think studies have shown that restrictive or controlled eating in childhood is one of the strongest predictors of weight gain in adulthood. But it starts so early. And I think it's Anthony Warner who wrote The Truth About Fat. I remember reading his book, and it made me just stop in my tracks, that it's estimated that 80% of girls in the US have been on a diet by the age of 10.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah, that's horrendous, isn't it? terrifying.
My daughter is 10. And I think when I can make that parallel, and she's already saying to me, she started to put on weight naturally because her body is getting ready for puberty.
Yep.
It's a natural stage, you know, they go out before they go up, mm-hmm. and they soften and they have curves. And also the body's laying down energy for what is going to be this hugely significant period of growth. But she is so self-aware. Mm. Mummy, am I fat?
It's so hard, isn't it? It's so hard because I really, so I really...
And she isn't by any stretch, but how she perceives herself. Because her body has changed and softened in a way that she doesn't feel it should.
Yeah. And also that the word fat is so negative, isn't it? It's such a negative. Yeah. Like, to be fat is one of the worst things that you could be. I mean, I use it myself a lot recently because I'm pregnant and it's baby number two, so I've popped out a lot more. I also started off slimmer, so went not very much, but... enough to make a difference. It's not kind of apples for apples if I compare the two pregnancies, but because of that I'm very much like, I hear it pop out of my mouth several times a day.
We are fat phobic.
Yes. Yeah. And that's another thing to unpick. And I think when it comes to things like the work that we do online, you know, as online influencers or whatever, it's really, really as important to be consuming differently than just being aware and looking at your feed. And I think I was talking to, I don't know who I was talking to, or maybe I'd heard it on a podcast. Somebody was saying, you know, don't just follow the people who you think are plus size, and perhaps plus size in Western culture is a size 12 or a size 14 when that is not even, you know, that's ridiculous, that's below the average anyway, but look at, you know, follow bodies that are really different, because it really makes a difference when you're seeing lots and lots and lots of different bodies. I know for me, I went through a phase of following lots of mummy bloggers after when I was pregnant with Anais, because first time mum, it was completely new to me, it was really exciting, and I was following all these mummy bloggers, and then looking at their bodies after they'd had a baby and looking at their stomachs and looking at what they were wearing and trying to manually work out what size they were in comparison to what they had been and what size I am in. Do you know what I mean? Like, her baby is 8 months old, my baby is 10 months old, should I have bounced back? And as soon as I stopped following lots and lots of these people and started looking at different bodies, differently abled bodies as well as different size bodies, it made a massive difference to my mental health.
Absolutely. And again, I do blame the media and social media for a huge lack of body diversity. We don't see it in the same way, you know, you've spoken quite openly about representation matters. We don't see it. We don't see it in advertising. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we do see bodies being portrayed, overweight bodies, we see, you know, BBC news story about, you know, how obesity is going to cripple the NHS. They'll play out the same old footage of someone in an ill-fitting T-shirt with a burger. You know, it's horrendous and such huge levels of discrimination. Mm. But, yeah, I mean, going back to what you were saying about, you know, making your feed, you know, pushing your boundaries, not finding yourself in this very comfortable little echo chamber. I mean, I started following Your Fat Friend. She's an anonymous Instagrammer.
Yeah, I know her. Yeah.
Follow her. She has been, or her account has played such an important role in educating me. And she'd referred to you and I as someone who was straight-sized.
That's a cool way of looking at
really
it.
Really cool way of looking at it. And, you know, you're straight size. You know, we can walk into a shop, we can buy what we need. You know, no one's going to judge us if we sit there and eat a McDonald's. You know, we are straight sized individuals. But her stories, and she's fighting for social justice and trying to educate people about what it is, you know, about the discrimination that people in bigger bodies and the prejudice they undergo and the negative stereotyping. She did an amazing set of stories recently about, she asked, how do you know you can trust a straight-sized friend? And she was sort of asking within her followers, and it was things like, and I got upset, and these aren't my tears to shed. You know, I'm sat here with all the thin privilege in the world. So, but as an empath, it did sort of really resonate with me. And people were answering things like, they'll take a selfie with me.
Huh.
They will, I'll see my photos on their feed. Because people were experiencing friends who were friends in the real world, but didn't want to show that friendship through their online persona.
That's horrendous.
Isn't it?
That's horrendous.
And I think, you know, that's, you know, going back to the role social media plays and social media feeds, you know, that anxiety we have around how we portray ourselves within that realm, and that we, you know, this highly curated actually even jeopardizes the relationships we have with people.
Yeah. In the very first episode, oh no, it will have been the second episode of the podcast, which will have gone out by now, I talked to Kirsty Leanne, who's a plus size travel blogger, and she was talking about the very specific things that are different for her than they are than for her straight size counterparts. Mm. And we were talking about press trips specifically because there aren't, you know, there isn't a good representation of plus size travel bloggers on press trips. There isn't good representation, full stop, on press trips typically. And she was saying that she's about to go on a really big trip, and it, there'll be camping involved, and she's worried about the, and she listed some of the things that she has to think about when she travels. And it's not just what I thought, somebody plus size or fat or, you know, however they identify would have to think about, you know, airplane seats, things like that. It was things like like liquid talc to stop chub rub, and I'm using chub rub in her words, although I use it for myself as well. But the sleeping bag, will the sleeping bag be big enough for her in her tent? What if she has someone who the tent is so small that it's uncomfortable for them? Lots of little things, which aren't little at all, they hugely impact her comfort when she's traveling, but also all of the anxiety that comes beforehand. And she was saying, oh, you know, I don't want to be that person asking for special considerations, and I don't want to be a pain and whatever. And it made me, I felt a bit heartbroken, because I thought, and that is simply because there is not enough representation, because if there were more plus size slash fat, however, whatever word you choose to use, people represented across the board, then there would be people who would think about those things.
Absolutely. But we are fat phobic.
Yeah. Yeah.
We, you know, and as a result, you know, we know that individuals in larger bodies experience greater levels of social harassment, lower levels of employment, the physical barriers that you've just talked about, you know, the world not being built for people in larger bodies, less pay, they're discriminated against in healthcare practice. We wouldn't allow that same level of discrimination now, that level of discrimination about gender, you know, if that was around gender or race or sexuality. I mean, and I know there's still a lot of work to be done in those areas, but, you know, we are so far behind when it comes to representation of body diversity, because we still play out this really simplistic rhetoric that, well, you know, it's for their own good and they should move more and eat less, and take no account that, you know, hormones, genetics, socioeconomic background, any of those things play a very significant role in someone's body shape. And yeah, you know, it's viewed as, well, you know, that it's their responsibility. And that's also the role of health, you know, the rise of healthism, in that we have handed someone's responsibility for their health over to them. Well, that's your problem.
One of the really, really great things that you do on social media, in your, because I think you use stories probably better than almost everyone that I know. You've been a very, ever since I've followed you, it's really your stories that are, they're a go-to. They're amazing. They're really, really funny. if you don't do anything else, please follow Rose's stories. And as soon as you were qualified, you started busting diet myths, which are so interesting. And there's like a different one per series, because it's not necessarily every day, but there'll be things like carbs are not the devil, sugar, loads of different things. And I love it. I live for it. It's so brilliant. Honestly, so good, because also that's a really important way of putting back on social media, putting the good stuff back into social media and not flooding with, you know, wellness crap. So where do you get your inspiration from? Is it questions that people sliding into your DMs and asking, or are they just typical things that your clients talk about?
I think some of it's a combination of the two, to be honest. I think I was quite taken aback because we are so overwhelmed with nutrition noise and information on the internet. And actually, that is one of the biggest problems I come up against when working with clients, is having someone who is over-informed by pseudoscience. So, you know, I know that I'm a sugar addict, and I know that my problems are candida in the body, and I've got leaky gut, and I must never eat carbs, and I'm going to go on the alkaline diet, and after that, I'm going to go keto. I go, okay, where do we begin? I think it was a combination of that, of thinking, and I got, I got cross. Yeah. I got cross. I thought, what right do these people have to misinform people to make money? But the thing is, their health beliefs, these people believe that what they're spouting some of the time, other times I just think they're there to make the money. I felt a sense of responsibility to unpick that. And sort of take the fear. I hear so much fear. People literally get frozen. They don't know what to eat anymore. Yeah. Because there's the information out there, it contradicts itself. It's confusing. Mm. And as a result, people narrow down what they're eating to just a handful of foods. And I want to remove the fear. I want to go back to food being food. You know, when did we start this sort of reductionist approach to everything, and everything had to be broken down into macronutrients and molecules? And no, eat. Food is a wonderful thing. It brings us together as families and friends, and it brings us so much joy, and it makes me really sad that that's been taken away. So if I can do anything to sort of counteract that and just put the evidence out there and say, you know what, hold on, you know, if that's still your health belief, then that's your choice, but here is the evidence as to why that won't stand up. And I guess I try and do it in a slightly humorous way, because it feels, I think nutrition feels so worthy these days. It feels so worthy with the clean eating and the work. It's hard work. Eating should not be this much hard work.
Yeah, it really shouldn't. It should be joyful, shouldn't it?
It should be joyful. And it should be secondary to going about leading a meaningful life and thinking and having time to think about things and having the energy to think about things and go and move and walk up a hill and meet your friends and do your yoga class. And it shouldn't be, but it's the first thing people think about.
Yeah.
So I think it's partly that. And then sometimes I do ask questions. I say, okay, let me know. What myths do we need busting? But I think some of them are so prevalent. They're so hard for me. And I butt against them constantly. Carbs.
Yeah. And gluten, I imagine, as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole kind of, I've been told I'm gluten intolerant. And, you know, the rise of sort of online intolerance tests, that, you know, it's all of those things lead people down restrictive eating holes. They don't need to be let down.
Because we know that it's so prevalent, and that like diet culture, without even realizing it, people who think that they are not consuming that kind of content might well be. What would you say the biggest marker points to know that you're following something that is diet culture, that is kind of promoting diet culture?
I think if they are telling you that a particular way of eating is going to make you feel better, be be a better person, lose weight. Yeah, there is no prescription. There is no one size fits all protocol when it comes to food. So I think if they are giving a certain food or a certain eating behavior kind of halo effect, and they're saying this is wonderful, it's amazing, it's done fantastic things for me, I think that would definitely be a red flag for me. I think when people talk about cutting out food groups without any medical need to do it, when there is a lot of attention on physical attributes and physical aesthetic, and I think if any account that actually you come away feeling anxious after being exposed to, whether or not you begin to question, I should be eating that, is it healthy, is it safe? I feel worse about myself when I come away from it, then you're being exposed to diet culture.
And actually, that's a really good point, because it doesn't necessarily mean that that person is proliferating on purpose or doing anything, because we all have layers of internalized misogyny, layers of internalized isms. All of us do. It's very hard not to. And there will be people that might unfollow both of us at various points because certain parts of our life are triggering.
Triggering, absolutely.
That's absolutely fine. I totally encourage it. Because, yeah, if anybody's making you feel bad, it's not that they're doing it on purpose. But the result is, if you feel bad, stop following them.
Yeah, and I you know, I think I've said that quite openly on my own story. It's about if anything I do triggers you, unfollow me. I mean, and that could be the fact that I am talking about this concept in a smaller body.
Yes, yeah.
That is one of the most, I mean, I do get that in my DMs. I get, how can you talk about having a healthy relationship with food when you've never been fat? And it is complex, because I have to call out, I have to be aware of my own thin privilege and the benefits that has given me. Absolutely. Yeah. Not to say that I haven't had my own disordered relationship with food in the past, but you know, that is one thing, and making peace with food has been very powerful for me, but I have done it with the benefit of thin privilege. So I'm very aware of it, I'm very open about it, and I make my clients very aware of that, because they need to be able to trust me. You know, and I haven't walked in their shoes, so I'm very honest about that. But yeah, as you say, I think if anything you do, if you find yourself being exposed to something that causes you any sense of body shame, dissatisfaction, and that may just be by comparison,
yes,
as you say, rather than anyone overtly putting any message out, then do yourself a favor and unfollow.
Yeah.
For me, it's Fitspo accounts.
Yeah. I struggle with those also. I wasn't actually following. It was someone had shared someone on stories, and it immediately, I then looked at their profile, because it was a kind of go read this person's stories, it's very funny, they're talking about this. Anyway, she's a psychotherapist and a mum of three. And there was a picture, she'd done a fake before and after of her in like a crop top and leggings. And one of them, she looked like she was quite bloated and had a... And she was talking about, you know, bouncing back and not bouncing back after a baby and all the rest of it. The second photo, she looked much slimmer. It looked like she had a flat tummy. And she was saying, these photos are exactly like they were taken seconds apart. I'm just pushing my tummy out in one. Just to kind of, you know, and for me, I was like, that's bullshit. That's real fake body positivity. Because to me, and so, yeah, that was an immediate trigger for me.
And it's been co-opted.
Yes, yeah.
The body positivity movement is not for people in a smaller body.
Yeah.
In my opinion. I mean, I will talk around wanting to promote body neutrality. I would really love for that stuff not to matter anymore. But yeah, I don't think it's helpful if, you know, I went, oh, and I'm having a day where I feel fat. I mean, seriously, no, don't go there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I appreciate that. But I think, I mean, I started weightlifting a couple of years ago, mainly to to help heal my relationship with my body as well. I saw my body from a place of strength rather than fitting any kind of aesthetic ideal. And then I'd start following these Fitspo accounts, so they had like little workouts that you could do with weights and so forth. And these women, they're just machines. And I was falling foul of comparison. They're so, look how strong they are. Oh, she can do 5 pull-up. No, don't do it to myself. Off.
Yeah, off. Yeah, 100%. You just, everyone's going to have their different pressure points.
Yeah, exactly.
So second to last question, and this question is one that I'm just really quite interested in. Is what do you think about veganism?
What do I think about veganism? Well, I'm all for it from an ethical point of view. You know, anyone that wants to be vegan from an environmental or ethical point of view, 100% support you. I think when someone has chosen to be vegan because they have the perception they need to do that for their health, that's not always the case. You know, you don't, it's difficult talking, I'm talking to you as a vegan.
No, but be frank.
It has been. I think veganism has in some cases been used to hide behind a disordered relationship with food.
Yeah, 100%.
That does happen. And there's no getting away from that. And I think it's about being honest with oneself about that. I see that in other ways as well. You know, I'm gluten and I'm dairy intolerant.
Mm.
Are you gluten and dairy intolerant? Or is that a way of reducing the food groups that you are exposed to? So that is something that exists. I think being a vegan, you can definitely be a healthy vegan, 100%, but it takes thought and it takes planning.
Mm.
Because obviously there are key nutrients that you need to be aware of, that you're making sure that you're still getting in your diet. But yeah, I mean, I think in truth there are certain labels that people give themselves as a way of justifying a disordered relationship with food. But obviously that is not all vegans. That is the minority.
Hashtag not all vegans.
obviously. But yeah, that's, you know, but it is true. And that has been, studied and we're aware of that within the
nutrition tests,
yeah.
It's really, and it's probably a bit of an unfair question of me to ask you that. The reason I ask is because, as you know, I have discovered that I definitely, that's where I came to veganism.
Yeah.
Although there are real solid reasons for me choosing a vegan lifestyle, mm-hmm. I have only just realized, like three years into being vegan, that I came to it from a place of, oh, brilliant. This is a socially acceptable way that I can restrict food groups. Well, and people will pat me on the back for it.
Yeah.
And I can hide behind it and say, oh, I can't eat that, can't eat that, can't eat that. Because, for example, things like cheese, I've always been a massive, massive fan of cheese. And to be able to cut that out felt very safe for me because it meant that I wasn't going to lose control and eat to the point where I die, which is how I felt about cheese because I loved it so much. So that's really where I came to mm-hmm. veganism from. I think that was my core motivation. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? It's only come to it years later.
Reflect back, but I think that's also. That's unfortunately diet culture creating this kind of very dichotomous thinking we have around food. Cheese is bad, it's high in saturated fat.
Yes.
Cheese is also really high in protein and gives us a great source of calcium. And if I could tell Lucy that she could only eat cheese for breakfast, lunch, and dinner snacks for the next 3 days, one, you wouldn't die, and two, you probably wouldn't want to eat that much cheese ever again. So, but that's what diet culture has done. So, yeah, I mean, that's where intuitive eating comes into its own. About I'm doing a lot of that misthinking and habituating you around foods that you historically couldn't trust yourself around, and learning the skills to enjoy those foods as part of a lovely, wide, varied diet,
and not freak out about them. which would be nice. So on that note, how can people work with you? How do you like to work? I've worked with you. I think you're brilliant. You're amazing. How can people work with you? And then where can they find you so that they can work with you?
Okay. So I have a physical practice. I'm currently based in Hampshire, but I'm hopefully very soon. That's a very long story. but I also carry out one-to-one coaching sessions with clients via Skype or FaceTime, any kind of preferred medium. I also have an online course that people, which is an introduction to intuitive eating, that people, if they just want to get a feel for what is this about and understand it a little bit more, that's on my website. Yes, you can find me at www.liveawarelife.co.uk. And you can watch all my hilarious stories over at Live Aware Life. So yeah, that's probably the best way of finding me.
Amazing. Thank you so, so much for being part of the podcast. It was brilliant.
It was lovely. I enjoyed every minute.
Thank you so much for listening to the episode. I hope you enjoy it. You can get in touch with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Lucy Lou Croft. I'd love you to leave a review for the show if you have time. All of the information that we chatted about in this episode is in the show notes. You can find everything at lucylucroft.com/podcast. See you next week.